Welcome, Dr. Monica, to Writers Series.
Thank you for having me, Sasha.
You are a researcher, a writer, and an author. Could you take us back to how you were introduced to the craft of writing?
Oh, wow. That's a good question. I was practicing in the fine arts at the time, and I was working in metalwork, gold and silver smithing. And I had two young children within 12 months, and we had moved house at the time. And suddenly I didn't have a studio, and with two young children was finding it a bit manic, really, to be able to set up a studio. And so I thought I might try a little bit of writing. That was easy to do with two young children. And then I saw this ad in, it was quite some time ago, but it was a Melbourne newspaper for learning how to write. And I still can see that ad today, even though that was more than 20 years ago. And that's really how I got going. And I've been writing since. And interestingly, I say to people that I write as I was a painter, sort of layering with textures to create some movement. And that seems to be how I write as well.
I found it very interesting that you have done your PhD research and your paper on isolated, segregated towns. What lured your interest to go out and connect with the locals and find out how communities exist out there?
So I think when you're an artist or working in the fine arts, you always often, not always, you often need to do other work to be able to pay your bills and live. And so as I was practicing as an artist, I was also working in community education. And so I always had a very deep interest in community, and particularly those communities that were vulnerable or disadvantaged, isolated in some kind of way. And somehow I just fell into that space of industrial communities because I noticed when I was looking at them that they seem to live very well together. And on the outside, people would say, that they were very isolated communities, how can they be happy? And I got to looking at one particular community who lived on a sewage farm. And the same thing, people would say, how can they be happy living amongst sewage? And then when I got talking to them, what I found was that they loved it and it was their utopia. And that's exactly what many of them said. It was their utopia. And so it got me into looking into that. And with my background in community, I started to understand that they lived a very harmonious life because they were left to live independently, and because of that, they were able to live with some social structures that they had created themselves, and then that comes along with feeling safe, and you have a social organization. And so that's really how I got into looking at those isolated communities, because I think the way that they have learned to live, we today can learn a lot from, and improve the way many of our communities live, to be honest. Yeah, so that was my PhD, which also resulted in me writing, the social history of that community, but in a very creative way, called The Faraway Land of the House and Two Cows.
In your opinion, and you touch upon this, was how those communities have been able to survive. Do you believe that it was easier to develop human connection living in those type of environments compared to the civilization that we thrive in the major cities?
Yeah, well, from what I've seen, yes, that's true. They were able to support one another in ways that today many of us don't, because we are so cut off, even from our neighbors. Many people don't know their neighbors. So, people go and work off in different cities. Children go and learn in different cities, and so they're separated from their communities. And so in these isolated communities, that's exactly what I saw. They became very connected. They were able to support one another in so many different ways. If one neighbor went without, the other neighbor would certainly be able to help them. And if I think about the sewage farm community, they were given two cows and a house to rent very cheaply. And the cows were for them, for the family to be able to milk their cows and make their milk products. And sometimes the cows would go off, and so they wouldn't have milk. And so neighbors would, without even thinking, would share their milk products with their neighbors who had none, because that's just what you do. And I mean, this community thrived throughout the depression and economic downturns, because they were all supporting one another with food. Not to mention, the social connections of dances and parties and gatherings and celebrations of all kinds.
Touching upon the concept of research, as a researcher, do you set a benchmark at what point you will acquire a certain degree of research where you will derive satisfaction? And also, because information is readily available nowadays, as an experienced researcher, what do you consider to be primary sources and secondary sources for you?
Oh, that's really interesting, because I found when I was taking down social history, everyone had their own subjective remembering, and what one person would believe to be the absolute truth, the next person would say, "No, that didn't happen." I had to be careful sometimes, because you didn't want to offend anybody, because what they believed had happened was what they remembered, and so that's their truth. So when it comes to oral histories, it can be tricky to decipher what is truth and what actually happened. But at the same time, then the other side of the research is the archival material and looking through those. And it's amazing what you can find online and in all the archives in the different organizations. And for me, it became a bit of a, I didn't really have a benchmark as to what I needed. It was more a benchmark was around the time. And, there has to be a moment where I have to stop researching, because you really can go down rabbit warrens, and you can research for such lengthy periods of time, because it just draws you in and it's so interesting. So there has to be a period where you need to kind of set a point where, okay, this is enough now. I need to start writing. So at some point, and it's even, with the current project that I'm working on, which is another industrial community around the State Research Farm in Victoria, and how much research can I do before I have to start writing these things? Because the other thing too is, you can keep researching and then you might forget, or you go down a different tangent, and suddenly the story changes. And I think there needs to be a little bit of discipline in research, otherwise you can just keep going forever.
We covered researching where we get to touch upon oral testimonies and reading other books and literature. In your other book, My Dad Built Me the Best and Wackiest Cubby Ever, you're writing from experience and you touch upon a sensitive topic, which is presented in a very dignified manner, mental health. And the book is catering towards ages about 5 to 12. How did you approach writing about mental health to address the understanding of elementary age children?
It was a challenge when I started. So yeah, that book is really about my experience when I had to tell my two young children about some of the behaviors they were seeing, because they were 8 and 9 and could really start to see things that were not making sense. My brother was unwell, and they saw things from him, but then their father became unwell and had a bout of depression, and they couldn't see anything wrong with their father, and but they knew something wasn't right. And so, as a parent, my motto was always to just be honest. And yeah, life is always going to throw you some real challenges, but it's really best to just meet them head on, and rather than avoid them. And particularly with children, then they go and make up their own story. So that book, My Dad Built Me the Best and Wackiest Cubby Ever, that was written based on my experience, because I wanted to help children understand it. But I also wanted to give parents and teachers and carers, health professionals, a bit of a resource, because when I had to explain it to my children, I didn't have that, and I was looking for that. And that was probably 15 plus years ago now, and I remember looking for it, and there was nothing around to really help me. The books that were around were kind of dancing around the topic, and it wasn't really explaining to children what was going on. And so after I'd explained it to my children, and I related it to the brain, and the that our brains have chemicals, and that they become unbalanced, and how that need can be fixed, and a lot of the times that can be managed. Fixed isn't really the right word, but a lot of the times it can be managed. Sometimes in my brother's case, it's a really tricky balance, and there are often relapses and all kinds of side issues to that. But I really wanted to explain to my children the physical side of what was going on, so that they could understand it. And at 8 and 9 years old, they did understand it. They were very upset. They didn't want their father to be unwell, but that they also understood what was going on. And so then after that, I kind of realized, I mean, children aren't silly. They understand, and I think we can underestimate how much they do understand sometimes. So then I set about writing this book, and I had it finished to a point where I thought it was ready, and had started to send it off to publishers, and there was a lot of reluctance to publish it. This is going back now 13 years ago when I started putting it in front of publishers, and they were very reluctant to publish it. They would say that it was really good, but it wasn't quite right for their list. Their list meaning, the kinds of books that they'd like to publish. And so then I revised it, and then it got close to being picked up by Penguin, but again, it's not really quite right. So, people weren't really prepared to take a risk on it. And then we had COVID, and things, and all of our lockdowns, and things changed after that. And I think we started to develop more openly, more understanding around mental health. And so it was now the right time to publish it, and the response to the book has just been incredible. The children wanting and understanding the story and enjoying it, but also adults, and adults reading it for themselves to understand themselves. So, it's been very interesting, the response to it.
The story itself teaches children empathy and compassion. And earlier you mentioned that after you had received some feedback from the publishers, you had gone back to revise. What exactly did you revise? Was it the story itself or how you were going to approach it in selling it to future publishers?
I was never going to compromise the story. That was one thing I was positively sure about, Sasha. What I did do though was I initially wrote it as a picture book, and then with some feedback, I decided to write it as a chapter book, which is the version that it is now, a chapter book. And so that meant kind of extending. Not really extending, but playing out the story, giving it a bit more time to evolve rather than a picture book. And then I ended up having two very different publishers saying to me, it's better as a picture book, and the other one saying it's better as a chapter book, as what it is now. So as a bit of a compromise, it became a chapter book that was illustrated with color images. So I never compromised the story, no. It was more about teasing it out a little bit more, from picture book to chapter book.
As for constructive guidance, you're a seasoned writer. How do you balance the feedback that comes your way and knowing when to apply it and when to defer
That can be very hard
it?
because it becomes so personal, doesn't it? I mean, anything that you write is personal. Even if it's fiction, it still has to come from something personal within you, I think. So yeah, the feedback, you have to have a thick skin sometimes. And, I remember I ended up working with a fantastic editor, Leonie Tile, and she just encouraged me no end to keep writing in the voice that I was writing in, even though many publishers said it's a little bit left of center. It wasn't, commercial enough. Leonie would always say to me, "You write in your voice because that's your unique voice." So you have to keep coming back to that, coming back to what your voice is, how you write, and that's your style. And then the other thing too that I would like to share really is that, you can get report and feedback after report and feedback, but they're subjective as well, and so you really need to be strong in your conviction about your story, and then strong in the way of your voice and the way that you write, but also balance that with being open to feedback that can help you progress the story you believe in and the way that you write in. And it can be tricky to balance all that. One of the reports I got from Leonie, she said to me, "Now, look, I'm going to send you this report." So she, prepared me and said, "I want you to go and make a cup of tea, and I want you to sit quietly and read the report a couple of times, and then go away and think about it." And that was really, really good advice for me.
After reading the report a few times, did you find yourself reacting to it or responding to it?
Both, definitely both. Yeah, you have to be very mindful. I mean, there were many times I would walk away, or I'd, go for a swim, or I'd go for a run and then come back. And I found every time I did some kind of physical activity, I was clearer and I could do things and see things more clearly. But it's hard work. It really is, to know what feedback you can take on and what feedback you think, "No, I'm not going to follow that." How you do that, I don't really have a straight answer, I'm afraid. It really comes down to how strongly you feel about your story, and what compromises you want to make with it. And then those compromises, are they going to improve it, or are they going to be detrimental to your voice? So there's a lot there to balance.
Have you ever been given any form of written feedback and you decided not to apply it, but later in time you said to yourself, I should have considered using that tip?
I don't know that I have, to be honest, because I remember entering or submitting my manuscripts over the years to competitions that were run by conferences, and I thought they were quite good, because you would submit your manuscript and then two people would read it and assess it and mark it according to this criteria, and I thought that was really good. And then after a few years, I came to realize that the people that were making those assessments, they weren't necessarily publishers or editors, and they were other writers. They were writers who were learning to write. And so that's when I realized that these assessments can be very subjective. I had the opposite response, which was I completely left them, because then I realized how subjective they really are.
As for writing tips, do you have one that you discovered on your own or that you were taught that could help new writers out there?
I have a couple. One of them that I used very much at the beginning of my writing, and it was this writing meditation, and it was really just a guided meditation to music to kind of set me in my seat and put me in a place where I can just write and not think about it. So it's a bit like, if you were, well, when I was working with charcoals, we would do these quick 1 minute and 2 minute and 5 minute warm-up exercises where you would just draw whatever was in front of you, but you only had 1 minute and 2 minutes to draw. So it was very quick drawing where you could warm up your hand. And it was the same thing with writing during this kind of meditative writing practice, where you would sit down, you would ground yourself into your seat with a bit of music, gentle music, and then you would just start writing and anything that came into your head. And it was a bit of a warm-up exercise for your brain to start writing. So I really loved that one for a very long time. And then the other tip that I would have was, which was a one given to be my Leonie, and it was to, once I'd written something, go through, and there are particular words that I would have to get rid of. I, only, but, those key kind of words, and also those words of, "Oh, I can see that," or "I can hear that." Look for those five senses: see, hear, taste, touch. What's the other one? I'm missing one. Look for those five senses and those five words, underline them, and then go back in and change them. And so there's some things that I would use and still use today, the looking for those five sensory words.
You are also a songwriter, and your song, A Land Far Away, was released a little bit over a year ago. Dr. Monica, do you also sing?
No chance.
What was your
No.
experience like writing a song versus, let's say, a poem or a chapter of a book?
That was the first time I'd ever been part of songwriting, and that was a very different experience. Because I was collaborating with a songwriter who would then go away and finalize the lyrics and then go and make music, there was more of a collaboration going on rather than me just writing something and thinking that's the way it's going to be. And so that was a learning experience for me to see a songwriter really at work and how they can transform the words that we started with into something really quite magical. And yeah, that song was amazing, and I just love it. And Elle is such a magnificent artist. I can't sing highly enough about Elle, but no, I don't sing. It was really just about writing, helping to write the lyrics for that song.
Dr. Monica, you're welcome to share with audiences any late projects that you're working on and how they can find you.
So my latest book was My Dad Built Me the Best and Wackiest Cubby Ever. That was released probably 2 months ago. And my social history, which is written as a literary non-fiction, that's Faraway Land of the House and Two Cows. Both of those and the song that accompanies the book, The Faraway Land of the House and Two Cows, A Land Far Away, they're on my website. So it's www. Monica, spelled with a K, Schott, Schott.com, and all those are on my website there.
Thank you, Dr. Monica Sharp, for joining us on Writer's Series.
Thank you very much for having me, Sasha.